You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we are talking about a very interesting development in as much as the chicken industry is finally, shall we say, explaining what is going on behind the closed doors. My guest is Vicky Bond. Vicky is the president of the Humane League, a nonprofit organization that works to end the abuse of animals raised for food. She is also a certified veterinarian and animal welfare scientist who has spent more than a decade advocating for animals. So Vicky, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate your time. Why don't we start by telling people what the Humane League is, because everybody is familiar with the Humane Society, but the Humane League is obviously a different animal, despite the similarity in your missions.
That's right. Thank you for having me. Yes, so the Humane League works to end the abuse of animals raised for food, and we do that by getting institutional change. So we ask companies or campaign for companies to make commitments to improve animal welfare in their supply chain, such as going cage-free for eggs and committing to the Better Chicken Commitment, which improves the welfare of chickens raised for meat in the supply chain.
Great. We're going to talk about that later on in the show. And you're the president, so you know, how deep in the weeds do you get with this stuff? You develop the policies, you advocate for, I mean, you talk to company presidents. How do you do your job?
Okay. So yeah, I am much more out of the weeds these days. I was in the weeds. I did help put together the Better Chicken Commitment criteria that we have as I was a veterinarian back in the day and scientist. Mm-hmm. So, but these days I'm managing a team that do that. And that team, we have people that meet with companies, like you say, CEOs. And I did do that. You know, I remember going to Paris once and meeting with multiple CEOs of like the hugest, some of the hugest retailers in Europe, and getting them to commit to go cage free. So mm-hmm. we have a team of people that work on that, that they meet with these companies, either with directors or CEOs, those involved in the kind of sustainability side of companies typically. And we work with them and try to convince them why it's important to care about animal welfare, why, you know, explain to them that people care about animal welfare, that they care about animals being kept in cages, that's not acceptable. And some companies will agree and say, yeah, we should change this. Unfortunately, probably the majority decide that they don't think that this is something they should concentrate their efforts on. And so that's when we campaign, and we will launch campaigns to highlight the bad practices these companies continue to do in their supply chains to the public. And we get a lot mm-hmm. of support from the public, because when you ask someone, do you think it's okay to keep, you know, three or four chickens in a tiny wire cage where they can't even open their wings? It's very hard to find a person that says, yes, carry on doing that. No, they don't want, they don't want that. It's not acceptable. And so, yeah, indeed. You know, when we launch these campaigns, the companies then take notice, because they have to. They know that it's destroying their image, and it's revealing what they do to animals.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk for a minute. Let's kind of set the stage here. There were a couple of lawsuits that were brought by the Animal Welfare Institute and Farm Sanctuary, which resulted in the first voluntary publications of the Food Safety and Inspection Service inspections of poultry plants in the United States. Talk about the settlement that was reached between the Animal Welfare Institute and Farm Sanctuary and the USDA that guaranteed access to those FSIS records without a Freedom of Information Act request for each and every one. Why is that such a game changer?
So back in 2019, the USDA and the Food Safety and Inspection Service, which is kind of a branch of the USDA, mm-hmm. This lawsuit was put against them because they violated the Freedom of Information Act. So the Animal Welfare Institute and Farm Sanctuary recognized that they weren't, that the USDA and FSIS were refusing to disclose key records that demonstrate their oversight of federal laws that protect food safety and supposedly sort of animal welfare. And they have been frequently requesting them, and they're not been finding them. So this they took them to court. The USDA tried to get the case dismissed. The court denied that. And so what it meant was they had to settle in last year in 2021, and they agreed to publish the inspection reports for the last for 3 years proactively. So rather than having to get a Freedom of Information Act, which means you have to submit all these things to ask to see these records, now they have to proactively put those records out there for us all to see, which is amazing. It was incredible work by both the Animal Welfare Institute and Farm Sanctuary to get that.
And that means that consumers can go on the FSIS website as part of the USDA and see those records for themselves. They can see which poultry companies are in gross violation of whatever poultry standards. Mm-hmm. But that leads me to the next issue, which is that poultry has never been included in USDA animal welfare standards the way that cattle, hogs, and sheep are. And so I wanted you to sort of describe that disconnect. And then also there was a later ruling, because the original animal welfare standards came out, I think, in the 40s. The Poultry Products Inspection Act of 1957. What is that? Does that guarantee any humane handling issues, or is that just about whether or not they're going to be wholesome to eat?
Yeah, that's right. It's really about food quality. But what that means, that food quality and animal welfare can sit hand in hand in some regards. So
one would hope so.
Yeah, you would. Yeah, indeed. So there are no federal laws protecting chickens. There isn't anything.
Right.
Chickens do not get protected. But there are food safety regulations they need to abide by. And they're supposed to also, like, there's guidelines that they're looking at. So when they go to do these inspections, what they may document, and it's very kind of unbiased, it's just like a statement of fact, is like, oh, we witnessed a bird violently flapping as it entered the scalding tank. Now, the scalding tank is there to remove the feathers of the bird. So if you give you a picture of what a slaughterhouse is like.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's hear it. Let people know everything that happens.
Yeah,
I happen to know it, but I'm happy to hear it again.
Okay. So I've been to slaughterhouses. I've done some work in slaughterhouses as a veterinarian when I was training. So when you go into...
Yeah, but not in the United States, I'll bet you.
No, but to be honest with you, industrial farming is very much the same all around the world.
Sure.
So chickens. So you enter the chicken shed. You enter the slaughterhouse. The birds are in crates. That's where they've come off the lorry. These crates are kind of emptied or dumped into what you imagine like a basin, you know, and the birds are all on top of each other. And then there's six or eight people standing there, and they're having to grab the legs of these birds and put them into the metal shackles to hang them upside down. Now, these lines go at like 145 to 175 miles birds per hour.
Birds per minute.
Per minute.
Per
sorry.
Minute,
oh my goodness.
My dear.
Excuse me. So this line is moving incredibly, you know, two or three birds per second we're talking about.
Yeah.
So they're having to put these birds on very quickly. They're hung upside down. It's painful for their legs. They already have leg conditions because of the way they've been bred. We can talk about that later.
Yes.
And as they're upside down, they don't have a diaphragm. So the insides crush their lungs as they're hung upside down. The birds often get distressed. And then they go along to the water bath stunner. The water bath stunner is where their heads should enter the water, and an electric current in that bath would pass from the head to the legs because of the metal shackles. That should stun them, but often it doesn't, for reasons either the birds are too small, they get a pre-stun and shocks them because their wing enters before their head enters, and then they miss the stun altogether.
Wow.
And so then when they get to have their throats cut, which is the next section, they're meant to come out unconscious as they're fully stunned, which they're often not. They then get their throats cut and they bleed out, and that's how they die. Now, there should be someone on the line that should spot any birds that miss that. But because so many birds often miss it, they often miss the birds that have been missed, if you see what I mean. And so then...
Well, there are very few inspectors. Let's roll it back for one second there and point out that there are very, very few inspectors on those lines.
That's right. Yeah.
Nowadays, they want to have the inspectors at the end of the line to test for microscopic bacteria.
Absolutely.
They're not necessarily watching how the birds are handled at the beginning of the process. I just want to make people understand that that's one of the issues that has especially evolved over the last few years as the USDA has
rolled back its funding for USDA inspections.
Yeah, totally. And these aren't actually inspectors. This person is meant to be cutting the throat, just that should be their job, but it's very hard.
Yeah.
And so then these birds enter the scalding tank alive. And we know that like 500,000 birds a year, at least, because these are the ones that the USDA have noted down, that is mm-hmm. happening to them. Mm-hmm. And like, as you say, the inspectors are looking for much other things at the end of the line rather than necessarily being at the front of the line where all the kind of things that happen to the birds are happening. But nevertheless, they do see these birds violently flapping before they enter the scalding tank and therefore being alive at the point of entering the boiling water.
And also people should understand the volume, the scale of this industry. We process over 9 billion with a B chickens in mm-hmm. this country alone every single year. So, I mean, when we talk about line speeds being this, eye-popping 145 to 175 birds per minute, that's why it's so fast, is because that's the demand, because we, of course, export a lot of poultry, and then we consume a huge amount of chicken here in the United States. Let's talk for a second about this new thing that was called, which I had not heard of this. It's called the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which was recently signed into law by the Biden mm-hmm. administration. So that's all about sort of more inspectors inspecting poultry plants. Is that right?
Yeah. So that legislation included like $1.1 billion for food safety and inspection programs. And so it was going to maintain this, I think there's like 8,700 frontline inspectors for, mm-hmm. for meat, poultry, and eggs. But that's covering mm-hmm. 6,500 facilities across the country. So... You know, it sounds like a lot until you realize, hang on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's like when you look at the scale, the 9 billion birds, and you're talking about a few hundred inspectors. I mean, really? Okay. And then you also mentioned in the stuff I read on your website that a lot of states have their own separate poultry inspectors that are independent of the few USDA inspectors. And the caveat with that is that if it's only inspected by a state inspector, it cannot cross state lines. Mm-hmm. But how are the standards the same between the states and the USDA standards?
They must be at least equal to the USDA FSI standard. Mm-hmm.
And do they ever exceed it? Are you aware of any exceeding?
I think they can do. I wouldn't want to say that off the top of my head.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And what kind of enforcement exists for these inspections?
There isn't,
right?
Yeah. I was going to say, it's the very short answer is there are none.
right.
Yeah. Chickens have no protections. Chickens have no protections at all.
Yeah, it's really, it's staggering. So mm-hmm. your report stated that according to the USDA, over 99% of all poultry slaughtered for meat is under federal inspection. But I'm struggling to square that with the 148 inspectors that you described elsewhere in the report. And they're looking at how many plants did you say?
300.
Like 300 plants. Mm. I mean, it just beggars the imagination. I mean, it's just the whole thing is so... so woefully inadequate mm-hmm. from every point of view. And I mean, I know your mission is animal welfare, but it's also the conditions for workers are appalling. Mm-hmm. It's something I've covered a lot on this show. I mean, it's the whole thing, and the food safety issues are rampant. Hence the the fact that salmonella was declared an adulterant by the FDA a few years ago. And now when an animal is tainted with salmonella, it has to be removed from the supply chain. But that's why we have so much salmonella in food poisoning in this country is, because a lot of times that just isn't, because there are so few inspectors, that just is not necessarily caught when it should be, despite their rhetoric about the microbial swabs at the end of the line and so forth. So let's talk for a second, because we have a lot to get to here, Vicky. A lot, I can tell already. I'm having too much fun with you. I don't know what to do. So let's talk for a second about the connection between animal welfare and food safety mm-hmm. and the role of the USDA in making that correlation between animal welfare and unadulterated or safe product.
Yeah. So most companies, the vast, vast majority, like 98% of chickens are fast growing chickens. So they grow ridiculously fast so that they can be slaughtered at 6 weeks of age, when typically they should be the size of a chick, but instead they're like the size of a full grown chicken. And this has had a massive impact on these birds. If we put that, just to give perspective of size, it's like growing from being born as a baby and growing to the size of a tiger in like 2 months. That's the rapid. Yeah, exactly. Like when you think like, oh my goodness. So of course these birds suffer from a lot of things now, and they suffer from painful leg conditions. They suffer from ammonia burns on their skin, which you can see sometimes if you look at if you buy like thighs, you might be able to see the burns on the skin.
The skin is reddish.
Exactly. That's the ammonia burns from those birds in those sheds. They also have white striping disease. Now, white striping disease, we did a report on this. We looked at packs and we found like nearly 95% of these chickens had white striping. You can go to the supermarket, look at the chicken breast, and you'll see these white stripes across the chicken breast. That is a change in the conformation of the muscle, because these birds grow so quickly that the muscle tissue can't basically keep up. And so it lays down fat cells instead. And so what that means is that this chicken has a higher fat content of over like 224% higher than it should be, and a lower protein quality. So it has less than like 9% less protein than if you were to get a kind of higher welfare breed that's grown more slowly. And we also know these birds have changed how they react to Campylobacter, which is, you know, food poisoning. So Campylobacter originally used to sit in the bird's guts. Now it goes through the gut wall because of changes in the metabolism of the bird. The Campylobacter can pass through the gut wall and goes into the blood vessels and then sits in the blood vessels, so that if you don't cook your chicken properly, this Campylobacter is sitting there in those little blood vessels in the muscle. And so if it's raw and you haven't cooked it thoroughly, you are much more risk of getting Campylobacter. So,
oh my God, Vicky, that is news to me. Now, I wrote a book about the meat industry.
Oh.
And when I was doing my research about foodborne disease, that was 7 years ago. That was not yet known, that Campylobacter was sitting in the blood vessels and permeating the flesh.
Yeah, totally. So it's not on top of the flesh. Like I said, it's in those little micro blood vessels. You can't see them. If you don't cook the chicken properly, you're at risk, you know, if the bird had Campylobacter, which a lot of them do. The other risk happens is when these birds come out of the, you know, when they're being hung upside down, they defecate on themselves because they're so stressed and so distressed from the whole thing. And so that then covers the carcass in feces. And so in the US, often there's the chlorine washing. That's a big thing. Yes. If you're in Europe, that was a big thing about US chicken.
Oh yeah, people chlorine didn't washing. Like that.
No, they didn't.
They still don't like it.
And it's not legal in the EU because of risks to human safety, because they're not entirely sure what chlorinated chicken would actually do to humans.
We don't care here.
That's your words, not mine.
Oh my God. Oh, I can say that because it's my show. Oh yeah. No. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's also, I mean, there are drugs that we give that like raptopamine.
Absolutely. Yes. No, it's completely illegal.
It's a beta agonist. Mm-hmm. It's illegal in 162, if not 182 mm-hmm. countries around the world. But boy, oh boy, we love our raptopamine in the US of A.
Yeah.
We have no idea what that stuff does to our bodies.
Yeah.
But we don't care because those animals grow faster when they're given raptopamine.
Absolutely.
So anyway, we're going to have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Vicky Bond from the Humane League and talking more about the plight of chickens in the United States. Stay right with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008. And has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Okay, so now let's talk about something good, which is the good commercial practices. What are the good commercial practices, and how do those get enforced?
So during poultry handling and poultry slaughter, inspectors can only document an establishment's failure to follow the GCP when they can demonstrate that there's been like a loss of process control, or they see like an ongoing pattern or trend of birds dying other than by slaughter. So, although the USDA refused to introduce regulations that would protect birds for inhumane treatment, they did introduce something called the Animal Welfare Institute described as like the GCP oversight program. So that is meant to oversee slaughterhouses' compliance based on welfare guidelines that the National Chicken Council put together. Now, bear in mind, the National Chicken Council is a lobbying group.
That is the fox guarding the hen house.
Yes, but yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
All right.
So it basically doesn't mean a huge amount in short, but it does mean that they do, you know, document instances of non-compliance, supposedly. But the reality is it's neither like really rigorously documented. They're just not doing it, and it's not particularly, you know, watched over. So,
right.
And it just leaves so much space for like egregious animal cruelty. Like, you know, like you said, the fox guarding the hen house, it just doesn't do anything particularly. It's pretty much ineffective. It's just sort of looking like it's achieving advancing animal welfare when it's not really achieving anything.
Right, right. So the report that you guys produced, it cites the practice. What your point in many of the, you know, in much of the verbiage of this report made the point that the practices, even something like the good commercial practices, these are basically about food safety. These are meant to protect food safety, but have no bearing on animal welfare. And I guess that's sort of a going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, like why there are no safeguards. There are no industry-wide federal standards for poultry, humane handling. And so how is that sea change going to be effective, do you think? I mean, like, how are you going to, I mean, there are things like your, you know, the Better Chicken Commitment, and I understand there are all kinds of pressure campaigns to be brought. But I mean, ultimately, don't we need to be talking about legislation here more than anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there's a couple of things. So within the Better Chicken Commitment, the criteria is to move away from water bath stunning, which is what I described earlier, and to controlled atmospheric stunning. And what that means is it takes out the live shackle slaughter element. So the bit where the birds are hung upside down by their legs and, you know, they risk the pre-stun shocks and everything else. And instead, the birds stay in the crates they're put in from the farm, and then they go into the controlled atmospheric stunner where a mixture of gases is used to first make them unconscious and then kill them. And so that is a much more humane way to slaughter these birds. And so within the Better Chicken Commitment, that's part of our criteria. But we would want to see that at a federal law. Like that's the future. That's what we want to see, is that water bath stunning is no longer permitted, and that we would be able to have this system that is much, much better for animal welfare.
And what would it, I mean, I can already hear the industry screaming how much it will cost them to do that. But it seems to me that you could automate a lot of that process and thereby cut back on how many workers you would need. So that could conceivably balance out financially. I'm just like making this up. But I mean, it seems to me that, yes, there's a lot of resistance to change, but that seems like a very sensible change to me. And you would avoid a lot of worker injuries, which happen a great deal, especially at the beginning of that processing line.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the worker's perspective, when they're hanging those birds upside down, they are much more risk of getting diseases. So the workers have a risk of getting infection from dust that's blown up from the feathers. There's mites on the feathers. The feces can get in their eyes or their lungs. They can get scratched from the chickens as well.
Sure.
So from a worker point of view, that never happens. The birds are kept in the crates. And that's that. And then from an animal protection point of view, as I said, like they would then go through and they should be calmer. Now, calmer birds do increase meat quality. So a stressed bird will make the meat drier. So yeah. The more stressed an animal is at the point of slaughter, the drier the meat will be. So again, it improves meat quality. And on top of that, if with the water bath stunner, often what happens is there is a conflict between meat quality and electrical stunning parameters. And what that means is to do an effective stun where you know the vast majority of those birds will be stunned, you need to have like I don't want to get this wrong, but I think it's a high voltage. And people often keep it lower because they don't want to impact the meat quality. Because if the birds, when they get stunned, contract their muscles too quickly, you know, imagine like you jump or something, then you get
when you get an electric shock, you jump.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? So you contract your muscles.
Totally involuntary.
And then that can cause blood spots in the meat, again, reducing meat quality. So if there's, so they often don't use the right amount of stunning parameters, so they reduce that risk, but then you reduce the number of animals that are actually stunned effectively, that increases their stress. So you might not be able to see that the meat's been impacted, but the meat will be drier and have less like water content and things. So there are all these things that can be improved by moving to a controlled atmospheric stunning system. And I think the industry knows it. We know that McDonald's, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world, are moving to controlled atmospheric stunning because they know this, it's not okay for people. It's just not okay for water bath stunning to exist in 2022.
Right.
It's just not.
Right.
It's incredible that this is the system that we're using that was originally designed for speed of just killing. It had nothing to do with welfare. It was never designed for welfare. It was just like, how do we kill as many birds as possible in the quickest amount of time?
Right. And this system developed probably in the 40s, early 50s as industrial poultry
Absolutely.
Production ramped up. So, but let's talk about some of the other observations that have been recorded by inspectors who the detail in these FSIS reports, which are now available to you people, in detailing animal abuse. I mean, there's more than just the failure to stun. There's, as you point out, the scalding alive. There were a few other things that jumped out at me. I was kind of like, whoa. So let's talk about that for a second. And then we're going to talk more about who has signed on to the Better Chicken Commitment and so on.
Yeah. So I think there was like testimonies saying that they saw birds' heads that were engorged with blood, whose skin had been torn off. they'd seen living birds being strewn across amongst the dead carcasses. They'd see decapitated heads on the kind of blood-soaked floor of the slaughterhouse. Yeah, there was plenty of this. And also, again, seeing these birds entering the scalding tank, seeing birds being kicked or thrown or stepped on while alive.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'm gonna say on behalf of all poultry workers that they work in impossible conditions. They themselves are routinely abused by their employers, threatened with deportation if they happen to be illegally, undocumented workers, which many, many, many chicken workers are undocumented. And they're undocumented for a reason, which is that they can be removed easily and without recourse. The sort of abuse that occurs with the workers, you know, sort of kicking animals or otherwise mishandling them, I can only attribute to the policies and practices of the industry which employs them, because I don't think anybody comes out of the box wanting to beat up a chicken. You know what I mean?
This whole system is broken, and it's broken so it can provide people with very cheap meat without thinking about the human cost or the animal cost that goes into that. And it's propping up a very, very destructive system, like you say, that abuses workers. These workers have no rights. They've been exposed. You know, during COVID, they had terrible time being exposed to COVID.
Yeah.
They don't get to have toilet breaks when they're meant to. There is very little protections for these people. And it's not a surprise then when line speed is as fast as they do, and they have to work for so many hours that things like this happen. Like, it's inevitable in some ways.
It is. It is.
And so what
it's
we need
baked
we,
in.
Yeah, exactly. It's bound to not go well. Like, there's just no way that this is going to work well. It's not a system that could work well. But what it does do is make a lot of profit for companies like Tyson and other companies who make huge amounts of these big fat cats sitting up there kind of looking like, oh, make sure we beat the line speeds up. Yeah, let's go to 175 instead of 140.
Right.
Why are we doing so little? We can do more. And never thinking about the consequences that has for people and animals.
Right. And that goes right back to the farm and the producer and the contracts.
Absolutely.
And the competition, the tournaments between chicken producers, yep. the guys who are basically in hock up to their eyeballs in order to continually feed these companies with more birds. I mean, the abuses from literally egg to table are just unbelievable. But let's talk about a little bit more about the Better Chicken Commitment, because there's part of the protocols for that are increased space around the stocking density is increased. In other words, how many birds per square foot. I think there's enrichment. Tell us about some of the things that you're looking for in the Better Chicken Commitment.
Yeah, so we have five key measures. As you say, we want them to have more space. So currently birds, as they grow, they stock them so densely within a shed, and we're talking about tens of thousands of birds in a shed. They stock them so densely that when they get to, 4 or 5 weeks of age, they can't even fully lie down comfortably with their wings. When you watch birds just sit and they kind of lay their wings a little bit and they just kind of nuzzle it, sit down. If you watch a bird doing that, I watch birds doing this. Sure. They don't have that. They are compact. They're actually compact in these sheds.
Yeah, they're jammed
in. Yeah, exactly. And so, and because we want to transition to a higher welfare breed, and that's, as I mentioned, the fast growth has such an impact on these birds. I like to say that they're stuck in like a physiological cage of their own body, because their body grows so fast. Everything can't keep up. The muscle's growing, but the organs and everything else can't keep up. So you see them having heart failure. They have really painful leg conditions. We're talking about like a third of the birds struggle to be able to walk because it's so painful. Up to a third of those birds. They then have this white striping disease and other things that they have something like hip necrosis, which means because the pressure on the hip joint is such, it kills off basically the head of the hip. So I don't know if anybody here has had a hip operation. They know how painful hip conditions can be, right? Sure. These birds, because they grow so quickly, have this hip necrosis, and it's extremely painful for these birds. So we want to see them transition to higher welfare breeds, which would help reduce or eliminate some of these conditions. We want to see improved environmental enrichments and lighting. So a lot of these birds, the idea is to make them grow as quickly as possible. How do you do that? You feed them. You have the genetics that they have, and then you feed them all the time. And because they are growing so quickly, their body's like, eat, eat, eat. So they don't even get them to let them sleep. I mean this, like they literally get like an hour or maybe 3 hours of sleep a night. And as with all animals, they need much more like 6-8 hours sleep. These are growing, growing little chicks at this point as well. So it's so important. If you think about how much small animals sleep, and these birds are deprived of it, the producers argue the reason for this is because if you turn the lights off for too long, they're so hungry that they smother each other running for the food. How have we got to a point where we have birds where they can't sleep anymore because they have to be eating all the time? That to me is just, it's beyond.
So they're changing the genetics is what you're saying.
They've changed the genetics.
When I wrote my book, the dominant breed was called the Cornish Cross.
Yes, the Cobb 500.
And that was produced by only two or three. There are two or three major companies, Cobb, Ventress.
Avigen, I think. Avigen.
Avigen. And maybe one other that produce, I'd say 90% of the birds, the genetics for the birds in the world. And so they are now tinkering with the genes to dial back, for example, the breast size and the rate of growth. Is that how this is going to work?
Yeah. So there are other breeds. Like you say, there's two main breeds, the Ross and the Cobb, that have been bred. And those particular genetic lines, the 500 and the 308, are used like 90% of the world. But there are some other breeds that still exist that can be used, that the Hubbard company have developed, that are slower growing. They're not like slow growing, but they are slower growing. And this does really, just by slowing their growth by a couple of weeks or a few weeks, does reduce the impact that we see of these diseases and of this leg health conditions, but it does need to be combined with that with more space, because also these birds can walk more and they want to be able to move around the shed, so they do need that extra space as well to be able to do that. So it's really
important. That costs money, Vicky. That's going to cost money. That's more weeks on feed. that's more time under the with the lights on. That's, I mean,
yeah. I mean,
I don't know how you're going to get anybody to do that. Talk a little bit about how it's, because you're European, you're British, obviously, mm-hmm. but the Europeans, I just want to contrast this with some of the standards that are baseline in UK and in other parts of, not all parts of Western Europe, but certainly, let's just talk about the UK, because you have pretty high animal welfare standards there.
We have animal welfare standards. They're not good enough. I don't know if you're surprised right. by my answer there, but they're not good enough. But we do have protections for chickens. We have the EU laws. We're not part of the EU law, currently EU now, obviously, but we do still carry over some of that regulation. And actually, it's a bit like here where you can go above and beyond the USDA. You can go above and beyond EU regulations. So the stocking density for the Europe is one number. And then in the UK, it's very slightly lower, but not low enough. So we have the Better Chicken Commitment as well that we're pushing companies to go to across Europe. And we have companies like KFC in Northern Europe committed to the Better Chicken Commitment, again, to improve breeds, reduce stocking density, same stocking density we're asking for here. Because there is clear science that shows that at the stocking density we're asking for, 30 kilograms per meter squared, is that these birds, they then don't have the same leg conditions that we see. They are healthier. They don't have the same level of white striping as well when you change the breed. So, but we do have protections in Europe. So there is something, right? And that means we can hold governments accountable in a way that we can't here in the US. Actually, THL, the Humane League in the UK, is taking DEFRA to court right now. We just got permission to take them for a judicial review. And the reason that is happening is because in EU law, there is a regulation that says you should not breed farm animals that would have negative impact on their welfare based on their genotype or phenotype. Well, as we just discussed with broiler chickens, the genotype and phenotype is really impacting the welfare of these birds. So how is it possible we have this EU regulation, but no one's upholding it? And so DEFRA is the Department of Environment, Farm and Rural Affairs. There we go.
Thank you.
So basically the ministry that oversees farming and agriculture in the UK, they should be upholding these rules, but they're not. And so only 5% of cases that are put forward is for judicial review. So taking the government to court to see if they're upholding laws get put forward. But our case is so strong that we are going to the Supreme Court in the UK and holding DEFRA accountable for not adhering to this genotype and phenotype regulation.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so let's to talk about who has signed on to this. It's a lot of restaurants and hotels and stuff like that, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we've got, well over, 300 companies committed, companies that you will have heard of like Burger King, Nestle, Sodexo, one of the biggest food service companies, but some of these companies like Sodexo have committed to these commitments, but they haven't been publishing how they're actually moving towards the deadline of 2026. So right now we're holding these companies accountable and saying like, okay, you've taken all the good press for getting this commitment, you know, showing that you care about animal welfare, telling your consumers that, you know, we care about animal welfare, we're doing this. And yet when we speak to you, where's the progress? And some of these companies aren't making progress. Sodexo is one of those. You know, they're massive food service. Yeah, Compass, the same.
Massive.
Absolutely massive food service companies that should be doing this. They've been working on this for years and still making no progress. And we have other companies, if we look to Europe, where that is happening right now, where, you know, we've got retailers in the UK that have reduced their stocking density down to 30 kilograms per meter squared. You know, we have this happening in Europe. And we need to see it happening here in the US. And a lot of companies have taken the good PR of the commitment and not done anything.
Right.
And that's not going to wash with us. That needs to change.
Yeah, I was going to say, how can you, like, I mean, I guess you can out those companies.
We are. Yeah, absolutely. Like,
exactly.
You know, you can join us in our campaigns. If you go to www.humaneleague.org, you can get involved and join our Fast Action Network to we send alerts out of things that we want to highlight to companies. So we're currently campaigning for Sodexo to publish their progress on this and make sure they have a clear timeline for how they're going to achieve this by 2026. So if you go to our website, you can get involved, sign up, and then start doing these small digital actions. They only take like 1 or 2 minutes of your time, literally. They're very short, but they have a huge impact because it really makes sure these companies recognize they are watching them, that their consumers are watching them, and they need to do this.
And how many producers have actually signed on to this, and who are they?
So we have not been tackling the producers. Yeah, we have some producers, but we don't have some of the big ones like Tyson or JBS or Pilgrim's Pride, for instance. We've gone with the big companies that have purchasing power, because these companies. That said, it's a very small market of producers, like Tyson, for instance, in the US. So they also have a lot of power, but the public don't know the name Tyson very often. They don't see it very often. You know, Smithfield's, Tyson, all these companies typically don't have a lot of a public persona versus, you know, say McDonald's or Sodexo or Burger King, for instance, have a much bigger public persona. And therefore, these companies are the ones serving the public. So they should make sure the food that they're serving to the public is of a standard that is, you know, reducing the risk of food safety issues, making sure birds aren't being cruelly treated in their supply chain, making sure workers are being treated fairly. You know, this is on these companies. They're making a fortune on our high streets. And so that's why we tackle these massive mega companies that are making millions and billions each year. Because they are the ones that are in direct contact with the consumer.
Right. I think we're just about out of time. We didn't get to talk about how to generate legislation for this, but give people more, go back and tell us what your website is and, you know, anything else you want to tell us about the Humane League to get people involved.
Yeah. So you go to www.thehumaneleague.org and then you can go to get involved and sign up there to our Fast Action Network. Then you'll get alerts on things, on campaigns that we're running right now. If you want to read about the slaughter report, you want to see all the horrors that the USDA inspections found, you can go to stateofslaughter.com and you will find the full report there. We also have a Live Shackle Slaughter website that you can visit and understand more about the process if you want to understand more about that. And you can sign up for our newsletter and you can follow us on social media. So look for the Humane League on social media and you can find us on Facebook and Instagram and on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter as well. And you can follow us there.
Thank you so much, Vicky Bond, president of the Humane League. This has been a great conversation. I'd love to talk with you again, especially about stuff like how do we push legislation that, forces companies to do the right thing. I mean, that is really the million-dollar question here, because consumer demand can do only so much. Yeah. And eventually you really have to get politicians involved and get the companies out of the pockets of politicians so that they can actually legislate stuff that reflects the desires of the population rather than the desires of, Tyson, Purdue. Although Purdue signed on to this, but Tyson, Smithfield, JBS is the company that owns Pilgrim's Pride. That's a big producer here. Sanderson's is another very big producer in this country. And as you say, some of those do not have much of a profile, but believe me, Tyson and Purdue get a lot of play. People know those brand names. They've done wonderful jobs of educating the public about who they are. And now the public really needs to see who they are. So thank you so much for this time. I really appreciate it. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. I
look forward to it. So long for now.
Yep. Bye.
What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.